Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, y'all? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
What's up? I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of comic books that have come out this week, and we review them. A bunch. Let's kick it off with a big one. A certified blockbuster, if there ever was one. Ultimate Spider-Man number 2 from Marvel, written by Jonathan Hickman, art by Marco Cicchetto. At the end of last month's issue, Peter Parker, now pushing 30, married with kids, finally discovers he's Spider-Man thanks to a costume gifted to him by this universe's version of Tony Stark. In this issue, we're getting his first adventures as he figures out what it means to be Spider-Man. He fights the Shocker, and meanwhile, in the background, a bunch of other things are going on with his supporting cast. I think you guys were very high on the first issue.
So
I was a little trepidatious about it.
Why are you trepidatious?
I explained why I was the last time, that I felt like it was a lot of setup, but we weren't getting into the emotional meat of it. I think we started to get into the emotional meat here. Mm. In this issue,
That's when I go to a restaurant, a steakhouse, I'm like, I would like the emotional meat, please.
I would like the version of an emotional garbage plate, please. Thank you.
Well, that's kind of what this was. We got a little bit of everything in this issue with Peter Parker's relationship with his daughter, a little bit of tension going on potentially with Mary Jane. We got some great stuff with J. Jonah Jameson and Ben Parker. Intriguing things with Green Goblin and Wilson Fisk. A little bit of texture of the world as well. And I like this new Spider-Man. I like the way that he is wrestling with, what if you knew my destiny is to be one of the world's greatest heroes, but not in a Harry Potter way, in a way of, wait, that was supposed to happen to me 20 years ago. What if I can't do it now? What if my knees aren't strong enough? That sort of thing.
I think that's such a good observation, because I think that's a core like tentpole of this book and this take on Spider-Man. It's the flip of the original Spider-Man was like, I know I'm not good enough. I need to figure this out. And he got by on his willpower and spider powers and sense of humor for so long. This is the flip. He's like, I don't know if I'm good enough, but whoof, I'm going to try and fail from the old side of things. And it changes the tone, but it hits that essential core of Spider-Man. And I think it's great.
I agree with Alex. I really think you should have talked about the knees more. You know what I mean? Like, talk about his lower back maybe hurting him.
Yeah.
Or, you know what I mean? Just like really get into the, when I sit down, I got to make a noise now.
Early 30s.
Spider knees. When I bend, it feels like bees. Like that.
Wow.
that's really good.
Having trouble climbing trees.
You can stop. I think it's
get my prostate checked real soon.
Oh boy,
like that.
I like the art has a cool factor to it. That's like a slicker, kind of cooler looking Spider-Man, even though he's older. The way the kind of new costume is and everything, it looks cool.
Costume.
So I'm having a blast with this, and I am high. I'm not going to come down because so far this is great. This is really fun to see him like get his butt handed to him by Shocker twice for being too dumb was hilarious and very enjoyable.
Very fun. And it's hitting the tone. I mean, you don't really think of Hickman as someone who's going to nail some Spider-Man comedy. And it does, though.
He does.
And again, coming at it from this older, and again, he's in his early 30s. I don't think we could lay off on him being like fucking ancient. All right. He's fine. He's living it up. He's probably just living alone.
Let me clarify. This near
MJ,
death
can we get some
Spider-Man.
Mushed peas for tonight? Like, I'm thinking maybe mushed peas.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. This is a little bit of a spoiler for the next issue, but I hear he has dinner before 4 p.m.
Oh, come on. That's a perfect time to eat.
Cheaper. It's cheaper. Yeah.
Beats exposing himself, but I do think part of it is like he's in the this black costume, and you know, light, very light spoiler here, but I think this issue is a setup for him wearing the classic red and blue, and it's about recapturing youth a little bit through Spidey. Ooh. So shouts to that.
Yeah, like lightning. I hope somebody calls him lame. He's like, oh, okay, Grandpa, put it on that red and blue.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I say when I encounter a 31-year-old.
Oh, God, we're so old.
Batman, hey, Grandpa, need help on your skateboard?
Batman 144 from DC Comics, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Giuseppe Camuncoli and Andrea Sorrentino. This is the final issue of the Joker Year One arc, as we're flashing back to the origin of the Joker, as well as flashing forward to the future, where he is having potentially a final showdown with Batman. Neither storyline goes the way I thought it was going to go. I don't think that's a criticism necessarily, so much as this was a surprisingly calm last issue, I felt.
Huh. I love this issue. I thought, well, first off, let's back up the truck here. Crazy cool cover. Just like some really great art to get you excited to jump into
the sweater
into
weather
this.
One.
Are you going to say
yes,
that every
you
time?
Know. Yeah, well, I know you're chasing that sweater weather.
Anyways.
That bat key.
This was a great issue. I mean, this is such a – the Joker is such a great villain and used so well here.
Oh,
the
yeah.
The art is super tight bananas.
Yeah.
I love this issue.
I've been thinking that.
I hadn't thought of that.
Joker. He's like the opposite of Batman in some ways. You know?
I also I love how Batman kind of took it easy on
Batman's
Jason.
Batman's a good hero. You know?
Oh, Alex, I'll say, guys, slow down with these revelations.
Sure, it's been said 1,000 times. It doesn't mean after you read a comic like this, you don't say it. You still say
you're right,
it.
You're right. I'm sorry.
You fucking
sorry.
Assholes. It's true.
Yes.
No, I agree. I mean, I think to your point, Pete, that's what
none of us are inventing the wheel here, you dicks.
I know.
I'm just saying,
our
Commissioner
bit is
Gordon.
You say something and then we riff on it for a minute until you lose your mind. So, again, we're not reinventing the real wheel here. You are right, Pete.
If we ever do the show,
we're
again,
your jokers. Lies. We're your jokers.
You guys are both going to have a lot to answer for.
Pete, we're your jokers. You have two jokers.
Yes. You're absolutely right. What Chip Zdarsky is doing here is, I think, regrounding the Joker is kind of what you're getting at, Pete, like reminding us why he is a good villain, why he's always been there, why he is tied to Batman, while presenting a different way, which is that Joker has always known who Batman is and always been working from that perspective. I don't know if I love that. You know, this isn't the first time they've done that. Scott Snyder, I feel like, always skimmed across the top of that. And he's like, maybe he knows he's Bruce Wayne. I don't know. And Chip Chazarsky is like, he knows he's Bruce Wayne. He's always known. But it's okay. I think like it's a well-told story with good art.
And I agree. And I like the sort of dual tracks where we get sort of the early Joker that it's still – it reminds me of the Batman the Animated Series Joker, a Joker we don't get much in the comics anymore, who is like, you know, had a good plan, liked to mess around, but was embarrassed by the end of it because of what he was up to. And like – we don't get that Joker because of all of the depth and pathos and darkness that have been added to Joker. But this is really good. And I feel like this is sort of getting toward what Chip Zdarsky is sort of trying to tell with a lot of his Batman work, I think. And it's really exciting. I also think it's interesting that Commissioner Gordon and Joker for the last, 2 years have been paired together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So much in comic books. And why is that? Because it's Batman and Joker, obviously, like they're always two sides of the coin, but it feels like Commissioner Gordon is actually a more oppositional character, or sort of the true other side of the coin, it feels like.
Do you think it's a reclamation or a continuation of Killing Joke in a way? That was the one where he was trussed up, naked, and thrown in.
Yeah, you don't have to fuck it. It's burned in our fucking.
Well, in case people haven't
read it.
Yeah, for example.
So just describe his nude form.
So he's lithe. Is the way I describe it.
What
the Commissioner fuck? Gord is alive? Wow. You don't hear that?
Nubile? Is that a good word? Nubile? Oh,
wow. Let's hang on a second. You did say something interesting that I want to address. That's weird that you describe Joker that way from the animated series, because I would describe him as somebody who does have a good plan, but is also just such a chaos factor and is so in love with the destruction that he brings to Batman's world, that he kind of spins out. Like, he's never great at kind of holding on to the plan or the idea, because he just kind of spins out.
The difference there is...
I'd be interested to hear what Alex would call the Joker from the animated series.
I would say a fetching lass is
athletic build.
You don't want to answer the question. It's fine.
Early 30s. I don't know.
What I was going to say is, like, you're like super old. What I was going to say is forgotten.
Oldest age I could think of. 31.
The Joker in the comics lately has been so far ahead of Batman always. Yeah. Constant, and Batman's always like, what is happening here?
But that's
the Joker
true, though, because if you're the guy making the evil plan, you are ahead of Batman. You know what I mean?
And that's natural, like, storytelling heightening, where it's like, yes, the threat has to be bigger, so Joker has to be further ahead of Batman. But I think we need a reset. The Joker side of comics has, like, there are multiple Jokers. There's so many things happening to Joker. I think we need to thin it back down a little bit, you know, make it live.
Remember, you said this, because later when we're talking about X-Men, I'm going to bring this up.
Oh, I look forward to that. I'm not going to be here for that.
It's too bad.
Blasphemous, number one from Distillery by Mirka Andolfo. This is the third ongoing title from Distillery after Gone and Somna, which we've talked about. Second issues of this kickoff here is about the biggest pop star in the world seemingly being an agent of the church, but actually being an agent of hell, among other things that happen over the course of the issue. If you've read any Mirka Andolfo stuff, it's very much in line with that, as makes sense. What did you guys think of this issue?
Ooh. Pete goes completely silent on this one.
I was letting you go first. Yeah.
Oh, nice. I was trying to pull it up over here, but
sorry, bro.
That's right. I like this comic. I feel like the Mirka Andolfo stuff feels like it's on a plane. It's not quite what I want. I don't know what it is, but I feel like, Alex, you love this more.
No.
You don't. Okay.
No, I don't. I think there was one of her books, Unnatural, I really liked the first series of, because I thought the metaphor was very clear. I don't know if this is that level, but I do think this is one of her clearer stories that she's done recently. I like the level of satire that's going on here. I think this is an interesting world she's setting up, the idea of pop stars as not just like the way that we deify them right now, but literally deifying them. That's an interesting concept to play with. It goes in a lot of different wild directions over the course of this issue, particularly because Distillery's first issues are double size, so you're almost getting two issues here, and it feels like that. So I don't know. I'm curious to see where the series goes. I would love her to get back to that clear level of story and metaphor that we got in Unnatural, which I don't know if we're quite getting here, but I like her art. And I like the fact that Distillery is just letting these creators go wild.
I do think the art is definitely a step up from the other, the previous iterations of, or the previous book, sorry. So yeah, I do like the art here.
The art is impressive. I mean, you know, there should be some kind of, you know, there's some kind of like stuff with guns and suicide and stuff in here. So I feel like it's, if you're not ready for that kind of stuff, it can be kind of crazy.
Yeah, trigger warning for that sort of thing. Absolutely. Let's go to an advance review. Napalm Lullaby number one. This is coming out March 6th from Image Comics.
Don't spoil it.
written by Rick Remender, art by Bengal. This is actually very hard to talk about without spoiling anything because there's approximately 30 twists that happen in the first couple of pages where it keeps changing the premise. But yeah, I don't know. It's a Rick Remender book that's been drawn by Bengal. It's exactly as wild and grittily violent as you'd probably expect for that sort of thing.
Stop spoiling it.
Sci-fi ideas going on here. There's a little bit of a fantastical element, and it's interesting to pair it with Blasphemous because it's also skirting along religious ideas and not parody, but what you'd expect from Rick Remender in terms of religion and how it affects the world.
What Rick Remender is interested in from a storytelling perspective, I feel like I also am so much. So I love getting a new Remender book. Also, another thing, Rick Remender always is paired with a fantastic. So yeah, every book that Rick Remender does, whether or not it's like right over the plate of your interests, it's at least good. The art's amazing, and it has big ideas at its core. And you know, some of the books, I feel like can get too dense or complex for some people or too dark in different ways, but they're always good and they're always unique. And this is just another one in that line. So yeah, definitely get this when it comes out.
Yeah. I mean, if Remender's there, I'm going to show up and check it out for sure. There's no question. I don't want to spoil anything, but man, it gets crazy. There's some crazy shit that goes down, and I do love the art. But yeah, I mean, Remender has earned the respect of it. Hey, he puts his name on something. I'm going to show up, man.
Yeah. This is, God, I wish I remember the name. This is very like another book that he wrote, but I don't know.
Fear since Agent? We're
not, what? No, not Fear Agent. Agent. There was another book that was like set in the future with people fighting a unstoppable power. I don't remember what it was, but it's very much in line with that. It has a little sense of like East of West as well, just in terms of the designs
great
that
Bengal
has in there. I know we're not.
Was it about a school of like killers that
I'll look it up while you guys are talking. Don't worry about it.
Oh, okay, great.
No.
When you Google things while we're
Alex,
talking.
I want you to listen.
Yeah,
I want you to
me too. I don't want
yeah, we're
you
saying
to.
We're dropping absolute gold. Constantly here.
Mark Maron is listening to this podcast being like, I wish I could do that, what they do.
Exactly.
He's
trying to replicate.
Take it easy. Take it easy.
Are you talking about Alex, are you talking about Tokyo Ghost?
Yes.
Hey, you're talking about Tokyo Ghost. I love that comic.
Yeah, it's very similar to Tokyo Ghost.
Why don't you talk about the motorcycle?
It is similar to Tokyo Ghost. I would say in style and some of the design, perhaps, but story-wise, I think wildly different. But yeah.
Alex, next time you think about Tokyo Ghost, just be like, Pete, it's a cool motorcycle. I'll be like, Tokyo Ghost.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, let's try to speak Pete more.
Predator, The Last Hunt, number one from Marvel, written by Ed Prison, art by Francesco Manna. This is, even though it's a new number one, it is the third, fourth series, something like that. In Ed Bryson's run on Predator, we're following exactly the same character, Theta, whose parents were killed by the Predators. She hunted them down. She killed them. She went in the last miniseries to a game preserve where the Predators were hunting people they'd put in stasis. This one, they've been tracking Predators for years, haven't seen them for years. They're kind of on the about to give up when they get a new lead. And I want to get into spoilers because I do want to talk about the end of this issue that brings in a absolutely wild character into this comic book. What'd you guys think about this one?
I like how tight the continuity is here. Like I don't expect it, especially with the number one, but we're getting a real full story here, even though each series sort of restarts. And I like and I think the theme here is that these characters, or our main character anyway, has become a predator essentially, but for predators. And I like that flip that is not explicitly told to us, it's just shown to us in a smart way, and just great stabbing and stuff.
I pulled the Zalbin on myself here, and
yourself.
I Zalbified myself. You were
reading a pornographic comic in front of people.
Nope. You know how like Zalbin will look at a title, and if it's got something in it that he thinks should be in there, and then it's not, like that kind of ruins the whole thing for him. Because it
really
like,
wondering where this is going, because there's definitely a predator in here, and it's definitely the last hunt. But
well, maybe you should shut up and let me talk then.
Okay.
So I was saying that like he, I saw the cover. I was like, oh my god. Look at this badass predator. And I was like, oh, it's the last one. This is going to be a story about the last predator ever. And he's like this last samurai situation. He's wandering the universe, whooping ass. And then I start reading the comic. I was so excited about the cover and the title. I wrote this whole story for myself in my head, which I shouldn't have done. Because then I opened this and I was like, oh, this is fucking humans pretending to be predators. What the fuck is this? And then I was really let down by what I read. And it's all my own fault.
That is totally fair, and I'm sorry for jumping on you. I think this is great. I really like the stuff that Ed Bryson is doing with Predator. Let's talk about the ending, which brings in Dutch's, aka Arnold Schwarzenegger's brother, who I don't think was in the movie, but has been in several of the Dark Horse comics and other comics, and he's the big surprise character there. That's wild to just throw that in there. And particularly because he's a guy who's like, I'm just wearing a Hawaiian shirt. I'm just a regular big old beefy guy. Let's go.
But why wouldn't you bring in Schwarzenegger, though, if you're going to, you know what I mean? Schwarzenegger's brother seems like such
I have to assume there's likeness rights that go on there in terms of using Schwarzenegger. And you that is a character who has appeared in the comics multiple times. So you can bring him in without any of the issues.
Having to ask permission. And also, who knows what's tied up in any sort of movie situation. Yeah. You never know when they're going to come back to it. So you can introduce a character. Also, anytime you want to add a little fun to your life or your comic book, just throw a Hawaiian shirt person in there. You know?
Always.
It's like a one-person party.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm excited to see where this goes. I was not expecting that ending. Justice League versus Godzilla versus King Kong, number 5 from DC Comics, written by Brian Buccellato, art by Christian Duce. This issue, Superman still not quite dead. Justice League still fighting a bunch of giant monsters. And that's what's going on here.
I mean, there's so much talk about how Superman's not dead, but almost dead in this comic. And it's like, all right, just to issue a little medical report or something. Everyone's like, is he dead? Did I kill him? Shazam. But we're getting a lot of just a wide swath of everybody doing their business. This is like a very montage.
I wish this was wilder is my problem with it. And maybe it'll get there. I think we have like two more issues or something. But I don't know. This is pure speculation. I almost feel like Legendary is so serious about their MonsterVerse movies, despite the fact that they're selling Godzilla X Kong as a buddy cop lethal weapon movie where they have to team up or they're going to hate each other. Like, you're not taking your movies seriously. Go crazy here.
Yeah.
There's a scene where Green Arrow is attacking the League of Assassins. Why is King Kong not there? They just teamed up in the last issue.
Dude, 100% King Kong
should be teaming up with Green Arrow and going hog wild on the League of Assassins. That's what I want to see.
100%. I want to see a King Kong in a tiny green hat with a big bow.
Yes!
Shooting a punching glove arrow being
please!
Like, yes. Kong good at archery.
Dude, I did think it was hilarious how there's literally a Kraken in the panel and Wonder Woman's like, oh, the dome is Kraken. And I was just like, oh, come on. I mean, what are we doing here? Come on.
Also, they keep calling the monsters Titans, and nobody is like, we have a team called Titans at any point.
Okay. You guys are advocating for puns?
Yeah. No.
You're pushing for puns?
Yes. No, I am not. I was.
Peter and I agree. Just, ridiculous. Peter, I agree. No. Needs more puns.
Wait, your first two complaints out of both your mouths were like, they had a huge opportunity to say Kraken with a Kraken.
No, and they did do that. I'm not saying they had an opportunity. That's what happened. I couldn't believe what I was seeing and reading.
Yeah, they needed a follow-up, though. It needed somebody to be like, get a load of this lady. No. Right?
Yeah.
Like a lot like
get
that.
A load of me.
No. Wait, I get a load of me. Here's the thing. I'm reading this comic book.
Let me be positive about this.
Nobody is quoting Jack Nicholson as the Joker from the 1989 movie Batman. And I'll tell you what, that Joker, that is a good villain. Okay.
Oh my God. Where does he get his wonderful apes? His wonderful Kong.
That was too much of a wind-up for that. All right, listen. So I would like to just say this continues to be fun. I know we're making fun of it, but I don't care. I'm still having a blast with this. We're getting giant monsters fighting superheroes, and I'm there's part of me that's in the sandbox somewhere going, this is fun. So I love this. So
there's always
it's your legs, right? It's your legs because we can't see that.
You never left behind that sandbox, Pete, did you? I think this is fine. It's not my favorite thing. It feels like this issue.
This were great. This is just
this issue is all business.
Down a little bit. Yeah,
it's middling. It's a middling issue. Maybe it'll be fun at the end.
Yeah. Spawn 350 from Image Comics, written by Rory McConville and Todd McFarlane, art by Brett Booth and Carla Barberi. This is the issue that changes absolutely everything for Spawn. And if you haven't been reading Spawn for a while, here's the deal. You're not going to believe this, all right? There is, get this, a war for hell, and somebody is going to become the new king of hell. And that changes everything when we find out who that new king of hell is. Yeah. Changes everything for Spawn, changes everything for the world, changes everything for the whole line. It is a game changer. Game changer.
It's crazy.
Alex. Pete, you're going to have your time. This is your character. This is your fun. So we'll just do a couple wheelies and then you can go to town. It's crazy. Just the fact that Spawn is trying to get in touch with his wife is really beautiful. It's amazing that every issue.
Have you ever done that before?
All 350 fucking issues of this book, he's like, God, I gotta get my wife. She's in heaven or hell or dead or alive or something. And I gotta track her down. I gotta get her. And he does it again. Right, Pete?
Yes. Alex, listen, what you're not really thinking about here is when there's a new kind of king of hell, it's just like when there's a new pope. You know what I mean? Like you get the fire blast in the air and everybody knows, there's a new, you know, and that's a big deal for a lot of the surrounding people who have to live with that new kind of leader there. You know what I mean?
I remember, so you don't have to tell me, I remember when they named the new pope and the fire just like pumped out of the Vatican.
That's a party pope.
The army was going nuts. I was losing my mind.
We should say the reason Pete really cares about the new ruler of hell is Pete is podcasting from hell. I'm in Brooklyn. Alex is in Brooklyn. Pete's in hell. So it makes a lot of sense.
I don't care. I mean, I laughed out loud when they showed the clock again, the countdown clock, because I was like,
it's very low.
Justin's going to have a field day with this.
Yeah. The issue, because that's how the issue ended.
350. What's hysterical is it went 350 issues and then came right back to where it started. Like, you've got the one. I mean, nothing has changed.
He's out of time. This guy's out of time. I think if you ground this issue up, this issue is like snorting pure 90s cocaine. Everything about it is 90s. It's Spawn. It's got Brett Booth drawing this shit. It's like Rob Liefeld adjacent. You're just mainlining 90s comics. And if you want that, take this down.
It's crazy that they never made a cocaine variant of any comic books.
Yes, I think that it's because you don't need it. The main comic is the cocaine.
Okay, all right. Now, let's talk about some positive stuff about this, because there were some real badass covers for this.
I said the cocaine thing.
Oh, yeah. My bad. But I do think it is this, you know, this kind of relationship with Wanda is such a kind of crazy thing, because it's like
get out
all
of here.
A sudden it's like, oh, hey, Somebody's got to be the king of hell, and I guess I can't do it because I was already the king. So, like, Wanda, you got to step up for some reason, where it could be literally anybody else by that logic. Why it has to be Wanda is insane to me.
The idea that they're choosing a leader that they've already had choices of in the past is crazy. Thank God we don't have to deal with that in our real world.
I'll tell you what, just to wrap this up, I would love to go back and reread the original issues of Spawn, because legitimately, like, that was a sensation. I don't know about you guys, but I was obsessed with that. I was like, what's up with the countdown clock? This character is fascinating. I love this art. This is great. Give me more of this. And 350 issues down the road, I'm like, why are you still doing the same thing? I don't understand.
But I still love it.
That's why. There you go.
There it is. Got it.
Guardians of the Galaxy Annual 2024, number one from Marvel, written by Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly, art by Kev Walker. Despite the numbering, this is actually the final issue of their run on Guardians of the Galaxy, as we get Grootfall finally flowering and bringing everybody back. We lose a guardian, but gain a daughter, is the way that I think about it, and kind of move forward from there. What did you guys think about this conclusion, particularly given that we've been a little mixed about this run?
Well, I thought this brought it together. I actually really like this issue, even though I feel like I've been pretty wobbly about this run in general. Especially, I'm a big Lansing and Kelly fan, so the fact that this was just felt like there was a missing piece throughout, and they weren't quite just pointing at what the narrative or what they wanted the story to be. But this issue, I thought, actually really brought it together well and gave Drax a great story.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great direction. I thought this was a very touching issue. I also love the back matter stuff. I think there, you could tell they put a lot into this, and it kind of shows in this. Everybody gets a little shine in a kind of really nice way. And we had a lot of questions about Grootfall and what the fuck was going on. And I think they took a lot of care to finally give us some answers to that stuff. So that felt very exciting. The art's unbelievable. The kind of whole tone of this comic was great. I felt like we were in good hands. And
like Allstate.
Sure, yeah. I mean, did you want to shout out like Pizza Hut or anything
else?
You're
in good hands with Allstate. If you set up a slogan, I'll hit it. My brain's broken. I hear a slogan, I say it.
Oh, okay.
Like a good neighbor, Grootfall is there.
Yeah.
I
agree.
Kev Walker's art was great across this entire
series. I love this vibe for Guardians. Kev Walker's 100%. Art is really good.
I wish I liked the story more.
Do you think
there were some good emotional beats in this issue? But overall, even though it brought it together nicely and kicked us into whatever the next era of Guardians is, this journey was not worth it for me, honestly.
I really think they ended it so well, even though I was like complaining about the journey along the way. I felt like the ending was so good, it kind of made up for it a little bit.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you felt like that. I did not. I didn't get that feeling from it. I will say, spoiler here, getting back to Drax's saxophone playing days was great.
Crazy. I agree. That was such a fun. Yeah. Deep continuity refs there. And to go out just like.
Saxophone style. Come on, man.
You know cool. He's playing Careless Whisper on that stage.
Yeah.
He's
Nightwing 111 from DC Comics, written by Tom Taylor and Michael W. Conrad, art by Sammy Basri and Francesco Francavilla. This is, let's get this out of the way up front, one of the final issues of Tom Taylor's run on Nightwing. Was announced late last week, if I remember correctly, that Tom Taylor and Bruno Redondo, after this, are going to be doing one more arc called Falling Grayson. It's going to kick off in, I want to say, 114 or 115. Whatever it is, it's going to run for 5 issues. So we still have them on it for a good long while here. But such a bummer reading this issue after that, knowing like, oh, I got to hold on to this like a precious gem. And this
I feel
issue,
like I've had my heart torn out.
Yes, and this issue is great as Nightwing teams up with Batman to investigate a copycat killer, potentially, of Heartless in Gotham City. Great mystery, great stuff going on here, and great backup story.
Yes.
This feels very reminiscent. I felt like an idiot because I picked up reading the backup story. I was like, ooh, this is like Francesco Francavilla style art. And then I was like, oh, it is Francesco.
I'm very on that style.
But it's a very similar like parallel story thing to what was going on in The Joker, the man who stopped laughing. So I assume that's why they got Francesco for that. Great package. Great comic book. Pick this up.
Agree. Total pack. I think we are always glowing in our reviews of Nightwing top to bottom. What I really like about this, that I think is such a smart choice from Tom Taylor, is to flip the perspective and give us the Batman point of view on Dick. We are always riding with Dick for so much of this run. The fact that... Dick... Guys, what's funny? Guys, what are you laughing about? Okay, because I'm talking. I'm trying to give a heartfelt review of this comic.
Okay, cool, man.
Yeah, go for it.
So I just love riding on Dick. We're on Dick the whole time. You know what I mean?
I think you need to set the dick down, bro. I think you're riding too much dick.
Well, that's what they did in this issue.
Sorry, we're making it so hard. I apologize.
Yeah, hands off Dick right now for a second, guys.
Let me see him. Let me see both your hands.
Yeah, hands up, guys.
Yeah.
Quit jerking me around. Quit jerking me around. I'm in the middle of my review.
I can feel it coming.
Stop, man.
We are journalists.
No, that's not true.
I think I saw this in the New York Times last week.
Hey, DC, can you fit all this on the back of the trade? Good luck.
We're going to need one of those extra lock back covers.
For yeah, this. Exactly. Do it. Can you do a gatefold?
Triple fold. Yeah.
Register quote. No art necessary. Or I have one idea for a piece of art you could buy. Anyway, this dick is perfect from beginning to end. What I'm trying to actually say here is that to see Batman's perspective on Nightwing throughout this issue is such a nice turnaround, and it gives us that same heartfelt perspective about this character from a different angle. And still keeping the same bright character tone that I think is just this run is going to be heralded forever.
Yeah, I agree. All right, fun covers.
What is this point?
There you go.
Hey, thank sweater, you. Bring up sweater, the covers. Sweater weather. You keep bringing it, Pete. You keep bringing it up.
Take it easy, ASMR, Justin.
Hey, yeah. It's sweater weather, guys.
It's, there's some real touching moments in this issue, which is great. I love it when they're showing her. To be honest with you, I didn't like the evil uncle storyline. I thought that was unrealistic. But everything else.
Interesting. Hit a little too close to home, did it, Pete?
Yeah. But the Batman Nightwing stuff was just great. Really great.
There's one line in here where... I should have written it down, but the thing where Batman
journalists usually do
says Alfred always called Nightwing my greatest success. And he's like, Alfred was always too generous. He was our greatest success. I was like,
I agree. I love that because we get a lot of Nightwing being because Alfred died, it was like, Alfred was my dad, but I love Batman being like, hey, bro, we did this together. don't get off that. Cause that is true. Alfred was around. I think it's a little bit retconning to say Alfred raised Dick when I think that Batman was the one that raised Dick.
I agree.
Batman's been raising Dick for a long
time. Effort. It was a team effort, man.
Yes, always a team effort in my life.
Yeah, I'd say Batman's been raising Dick since 1939, but that's not accurate.
I don't think the dates are right on that.
No, they're not.
Yeah, but the raising is right.
Yeah, he's been raising Dick on several dates. Anyway, Man's Best Ashcan number one from Boom Studios, written by Port Sagan, art by Jesse Lottergan.
Sorry, can we win an Emmy? Are we up for it? Let's just clip this last bit out. I think it's good.
Sorry, The White Lotus, season three.
The Dark Horse, the candidate, Comic Book Club's review of Nightwing.
Normally we don't give Emmys for podcasts, but Man's Best Ashcan, again, this is Boom Studios releasing a book a month early as a promotional thing, I think. Here we're getting about like half, three quarters of the issue. I want to say something like that. Somebody else go, because I can't stop coughing.
Okay. But well, I think
this is very we three is what I listen.
Like way over the plate. But Pete, this is you. It's got cats. You love cats. Puff the Fluff.
Yeah. It's a really great book.
Got him. Oh, sorry. I got Pete.
Justin, you got to take the podcast home. You take it. We're gone.
This is so what I like about this is it's so we three out of the gate, the classic Grant Morrison comic that was so popular when that came out. And then this shattered. I don't even know what's happening.
I haven't seen Pete laugh this much in a very
long. I know, it's great.
Oh my God.
It's nice. But it turns over the issue, and it doesn't feel like it's in that world too much and becomes something completely different, which I think was really nice. And I actually thought of Pete a lot because Pete is such a pet/cat lover that this is right over the plate for you.
I thought this was a really cool first issue. Love the art style. Don't start, Salvin. I love the art style. It kind of sets a really great world for this comic. I really can't wait for more, you know, Pets in Space. I mean, who doesn't love it?
Yeah, I think it's a really good mark of this sort of thing that I got to.
Yes.
That it just kind of cut off about two-thirds of the way through. And I was like, oh, I was enjoying this. This is so sweet and wonderful that I want to know more about these characters. So very excited to read it when it actually comes out. Also kind of funny to read it as Man's Best Ashcan, like it's the best Ashcan a man has ever had.
Yeah.
Next up, Cobra Commander number two from Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Andrea Milana. This is continuing the saga of Cobra Commander as he is out in the world looking for Energon. Meanwhile, we're getting some flashbacks to stuff that happened in Cobra Law back in the day. Pete, you're a big G.I. Joe fan here. What'd you think?
Yeah, this is, I mean, first off, great cover. Of course, you have Buzzer on there of the dreadlocks.
Sweater weather, Cobra Commander.
No, it was just a regular cover. Just a regular cover.
Yeah. I drew one with him in a Speedo.
Oh, boy. He still had the mask on, right?
Yeah, that's the real Cobra Commander. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, wow. So anyways, I like the fact that we finally got the dreadlocks in there since they teased it at the end of the last issue. I wanted to kind of get more of that a little bit. But this is a lot darker. I keep forgetting how dark it is. I'm like, oh, G.I. Joe, the G.I. Joe I know and love. And then Joshua Williamson keeps going like, no, bro, this is a lot more fucked up than you think this is.
But I like that. I like that because the tone of this book is wild. It's like super violent and dark. And then Cobra Commander is sort of a goof. He's sort of like this. He reminds me of from Saga, the prince with the TV head.
Interesting.
Prince Robot.
Prince Robot. Yeah. He reminds me of him so much where he's sort of this like he's in the world and he's like, I have to do this, but he's like not good at talking to people or doing much so far. And it's just such a funny tone to strike for something that you would expect to be way more over the plate of a Cobra Commander. And he's on Earth. He's like, Earth sucks. You know, it's cool. Cobra Law. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? Mask guy. And it's just, I think it's such an interesting, and we talked to Joshua about this when he was on the podcast like a month ago or so.
We should have talked to him about this.
Yeah, I think I said that we literally did. And it is true that he's striking such a unique tone with this, and it's definitely worth picking up.
But it does feel like Cobra Commander. You know, sometimes people take big swings with characters and it feels a little bit out of pocket. But this is still very in pocket for Cobra Commander, which I think makes it work. So it's kind of fun to see all the different madness going on.
Rise of the Powers of X, number 2 from Marvel, written by Kieran Gillen, art by R.B. Silva.
Arby's?
Arby's. How best to describe what happens in this issue? So, the last remaining dregs of the X-Men in the future are fighting back against Enigma, who is the real Nathaniel Essex, a.k.a. the real Mr. Sinister, who has become a Dominion, an all-encompassing universe-destroying robot. They're trying to stop him any way they can. A lot of this issue is spent with strategizing around that in different ways and trying to figure out what the next step is, as well as looping back to the continuity of Dead X-Men, something we questioned when we read Dead X-Men. So we get some answers about what's going on there in this issue. This is very much to me Kieran Gillen in die mode, meaning the comic book die, where it's very much like, I'm creating a role-playing game, and let's figure out what all the characters are going to do. And this is the point where they all sit around the table and be like, okay, what do we do before we roll the dice?
They're planning the campaign.
Exactly. And then finally they do at the end, so we're going to get some action. Next issue, I like this, but this is very much like you need to fully 100% concentrate on what you're reading here or you are going to be lost. And I'll tell you, I was concentrating the entire time and there were still several pages where I was like,
oh, thank God. Because I was
specifically, I want to throw out something. There are two pages where it looks like Doug has been taken over by Enigma.
Exactly. The same thing. He gets a diamond on his head, right?
Right. And then it seems like they're out of place. Maybe they were presented in the wrong order or something. I don't know.
I was very confused by that too. Because, and then later, I feel like Cypher looks different. His hair's darker.
It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. And especially when it's like, he's like, I'm a clone. I was like, what? A clone of Cypher?
Yeah.
That's got to be way down in the list of X-Men you want to clone. Bottom of the clone list.
I do want
to. Don't clone him. Just get a regular person to take his place who speaks French or whatever.
I have no idea what is happening, but the volcano money shot was, I think, a beautiful panel that we got there. Just amazing art. I don't care about the bearded, almost Professor Xavier guy.
It is Professor Xavier. That is who that is.
It's a copy. I don't know who that is.
I think that actually is him.
Yeah, it is him.
Well, you don't like the beard? What's happening?
I don't know what's happening.
It's a good beard. That beard flows.
Oh my God.
You know what I mean?
That's a good beard.
It's like he's not underwater, but it's like the beard is.
Also, Storm in a weird egg sack. I don't know what's happening. Storm.
That's Mother Righteous.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a lot going on there, and I don't want to break it down too much. But Mother Righteous, who is also a clone of Mr. Sinister and somebody else at the same time, who is redacted in one of the text pages, has been captured in the future by Professor X, and they are using her for information. She's in the egg sac, which prevents her from using magic or not helping them. Basically, it's like a truth serum egg sac that saps her powers. At the same time, she is in the white hot room where 250,000 mutants are. Presumably, the way that I understand it, they have been there since the Hellfire Gala, and now we're at least 10 years in the future. They're still trapped there, and the whole thing is starting to fall apart. That's what I'm getting from this issue.
Yeah, and it's hard to tell what that all amounts to. Mm-hmm. The positives here, I think the art is amazing. I like the way that we're seeing flashes from other parts of this in different ways, which is fun, but it's in general, it is just a little bit dense. I want it just a little bit pared back for clarity. But you can tell that Kieran loves Rasputin 4. And I will say Rasputin 4 is cool and has become like sort of from a chess point of view, Professor X is like queen piece. Mm-hmm. Like I'm just going to keep using you to go kill, the same way that he used Cyclops in the past in different characters. And I'm curious if we're going to explore that idea, because that's an interesting place.
Pete has raised his hand. Pete, what's going on?
Yeah, I have a question. Alex, you went into this whole description. Was that fun? Are you having fun?
Nah.
I'm intrigued. And I think the thing that I'm probably going to take away from this whole era of X-Men is, from the very beginning when Jonathan Hickman set it up, is it was to challenge us intellectually on a science fiction level, science fiction fantasy level, very much, because it's not delving into any actual science or anything like that. That's a different mode for the X-Men. And when Professor Xavier in this issue is talking about, like, Krakoa was a failed experiment, it didn't work, we got to erase it from history, that bummed me out a little bit. Like, I don't know where you go from there or how you keep it around necessarily, but the idea of, like, well, we tried this thing, it feels very metatextual of, we tried this thing in comics for several years, it's not going to work long term.
That's not Professor Xavier. You can't all of a sudden just be younger and have working legs and a beard. Like, what?
It's beard.
You can't. You died. You died like a bunch of times.
You can't just suddenly have a beard. You got to.
You died like a bunch of times, and now all of a sudden you're younger with like a beard and just walking around in a suit.
They literally resurrected themselves from egg sacs as their best versions. That's what happened.
Yeah, you don't like egg sacs, Pete, clearly.
Mm-hmm. I'm not having fun with all this. This is,
well, great news. It's going to be done in like 2 months.
Four versions of something that's like.
And here's the thing. You bet you're going to have fun right after this. Because once this ends, it's going to go back to a more standard X-Men situation. They're gonna probably live in some sort of house. They're gonna be hated, and
I don't want this young fake Professor Xavier thinking he can just like.
So you want him to be like,
yeah, you want somebody to be like, take his legs.
Yeah, you feel weird because he's like 29, and you want him to be like 31. Right.
The oldest
saying.
Possible age.
Yeah, it's disgusting that he's 29.
Can we move on and talk about Wonder Woman number 6 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Daniel Semperi and Belen Ortega? In this issue, Wonder Woman is taking on pretty much her entire rogues gallery at the behest of the Sovereign. In the backup story, we're once again getting these Super Sons babysitting for Trinity. This is great.
Great pack.
Iffy about the series. I was on board as of the last issue. I'm even more on board with this issue. The action scenes are killer.
Great action.
In the front story. Oh my God. So good. Such a build. So much tension going on here. And I laughed out loud multiple times at the backup story. This is great. Again, tight package.
Tight package.
A great 1-2, and I will say the one thing, like, what is, I think you, when you see a Tom King book, you're like, oh, interesting, what's the take here? This is one where I feel like the take is just, let's smash some stuff, and I'm surprised, but I keep, and this is not right of me to think this, I expect there to be another idea here, and maybe there just isn't, and we're getting a lot of anticipation building towards something. And we'll get to that, I'm sure, soon.
Enjoy,
but it definitely
the ride, man.
It feels like that's what this is.
Well, I think the difference is a lot of his takes are about breaking down characters, and he's now moved into a building up phase. That's happening over in Penguin. That's happening in Wonder Woman as well.
That's true.
Where rather than being like these icons,
this is Wonder Woman.
How do we make them more human? Wonder Woman, he's very specifically like, she's unstoppable. And even in this issue where she gets the crap beaten out of her for multiple pages, it ends with the Sovereign's narration telling us, nope, this was the biggest mistake I possibly could have made. I really screwed up here in this moment when it seemed like she lost. And I think that's really what this is about, is he came into this with the idea of Wonder Woman, for whatever reason, has been seen as a tertiary character to Batman and Superman. Let's make sure she is on that level. And she's the one character you can't have a Mary Sue, like a straw man Mary Sue argument about, because she backs it up from decades of history at this point.
Yeah.
So to throw her in a direction where it's like, she's got the plans. She knows what she's doing. She is clear on herself and what her mission is at all points. This isn't about her growth. It's about how she triumphs over these villains and pushes through no matter what.
Her unstoppability.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is just a badass issue. It was such an epic fight. I loved it. I mean, it was just the art, the coloring. It's just such an action-packed issue. And I love – that's one of the my favorite things about Wonder Woman is they do a lot of great stuff with this character. They push her in a lot of different directions. But you got to come back to the Wonder Woman is the most badass person you can ever go up against. And you're going to lose, man. You're not going to outwork Wonder Woman. You're not going to outsmart her. You're not – you just – it's just awesome. And it's when done right, it's glorious. And this is a glorious issue.
Elvira meets H.P. Lovecraft, number one from Dynamite, written by David Avalon, art by Kuber Ball. I was a little nervous when they announced this just because I was like, H.P. Lovecraft, kind of racist. What are we going to do here? But – they dive right into that. Elvira spends the entire issue making this the roast of H.P. Lovecraft. and it's kind of delightful. I had a very good time reading this book. Very fun.
It's funny, like, that because I was like, who is this for? And honestly, like, they just were like, it's just for fun. And I was like, nailed it. Good.
Yeah.
And they did all the things just the cover alone of him being like, I'm a creep. It was like, okay, great. And they carried that through.
I agree. This was actually a lot more fun than I was ready for or thought it was going to be. It just, I mean, there was a lot of fun things about this, the back and forth. Elvira always has great banter and when used well can be such a kind of great for pacing and kind of keeping things light. So I just felt like it was good. And also the kind of fun monster villain reveal at the end was also enjoyable. So yeah.
Great. Yeah. It works as a H.P. Lovecraft tribute at the same time as they're literally like, you are a racist, horrible person in the comic book. So fun stuff. Good job, team. Midlife number 5 from Image Comics, written once again by Bruin Bucciolato, art by Stefano Simeone. We are following a character who is impervious to fire, control fire. We find a lot about his mythology in this issue, as he also, spoilers here, gets to the refusal of the call part of being a hero. What'd you guys think about this one?
Yeah, this was a fun fire rescue. Love the art. Gets a little weird at the end, but I'm still enjoying this.
I like this as well. Great use of flashback at the beginning of this issue and the previous ones. And I just think this is like a great over the plate, good hero story, something that we don't get a ton of, just like a, like we were talking about at the top of the show, like a Spider-Man style origin story of someone who's like, oh, look, I can do this. How do I do this? Oh no, I'm messing up. How can I fix this? Like that is such a, it's a core text in superhero comics and it's hard to find. And this one does it.
It reminds me, I mean, this might be the costume a little bit, but it reminds me a little bit of the Rocketeer at its best. There's a bunch of mythology stuff that goes on here in terms of fire demons or fire imps or something like that. And that's the stuff that I hope they like get past and leave behind, because to your point, Justin, the stuff that I'm really enjoying here is him hanging out with his family being like, I'm 50 years old. I can't be a hero.
Yeah.
My knees, I'm not 31. My knees.
My back. My knees.
Oh, God, my knees. I love these comics where these heroes talk about their knees, you know?
Spider knees.
Oh, boy.
Fire knees, fire knees. Spider-Boy, number 4 from Marvel, written by Dan Slott, art by Paco Medina and Ty Templeton. In this issue, we're getting a little riff on the front story, backstory thing, where in front story, we get a reverse Spider-Boy who is attacking the city, doing horrible things like enjoying movies. And then from the backup story, we get his perspective and find out a lot more about him.
Boy Spider.
Boy Spider. I'll tell you what, I was a little iffy about the front story, and then when I read the back story, I liked it 1 million times better.
I liked Dan Slott's playing around a little bit, and I know I've been a little bit trepidatious when it comes to Spider-Boy, but I gotta say, I liked leaning into the fun and comedy. There's some great Fast and the Furious jokes in this front story that I was like, oh, this is a great joke. Well executed. And the idea of telling sort of almost comic strip style, like comic book storytelling here, where, you know, you have to read both of them to sort of get what's happening. They're in communication with each other. That's fun.
Yeah, I just think that I love there's a lot of fun lines in here. I love I think I should get free nachos for life line. That was great. I feel like the art does a great job of setting the fun tone for this issue. You know, it feels like Slott's having a great time. I love the pace, the action, people working together. Also great teaser for the next issue on that kind of like last page. I thought that was really cool. The elephant stomp.
And Pete, you're in a legal battle over nachos for life as well. So I think just be careful what you say. You don't want to affect your case.
Oh, great. Yeah. Come at me, B-dubs. Come at me.
Buffalo Wild Wings?
Yeah.
Oh. Green Lantern War Journal. I hate that I knew that. Green Lantern War Journal number 6 from DC Comics. Written by Philip Kennedy Johnson. Art by Montos. We are getting John Stewart versus the Radiant Dead. Light-based enemies who are attacking him from another dimension. We get some emotional stuff with his mom and sister here. This title is great.
It's a defining Green Lantern story, especially for a Green Lantern that we don't get a ton of exploration of. And so that's really nice to see here. And I think Philip Kennedy Johnson just cares for the characters he's writing so much. And that's why I feel like you get the combination of just like big action at the same time of hitting these emotional beats and telling a great story.
Yeah, I mean, cool ass cover. Loved all the action. Interesting monster.
Sweater weather.
Thank you. Interesting monster villain. Great art. Total pack.
The Holy Roller, number 4 from Image Comics, written by Rick Remender, Andy Samberg, and Joe Troman, art by Roland Boski. So last issue, I complained a little bit that they were probably going to take 6 issues to slowly build him into a superhero costume, get him to a point of being a hero.
Nope.
Just there.
Suck it, Zelps.
I'll tell you what. Weird pacing there, though, at the same time, where I felt like I had missed an issue at some point. But if you were looking forward to what was teased on the first cover, guy in a costume beating up people with superpowered bowling balls, that's what you get.
Oh, if you want to see some wrecked faces, like, you got a lot of bowling balls wrecking jaws in this cover.
Oh, yeah. Wrecking jaws. Yeah, I thought this was just very badass, and also the combo of kind of the darkness of Remender with the comedy of the Samberg there. I think this is just such a great team. The art's kind of fun and really does a great job of setting a cool pace with the quips and the action and the grossness and the... Yeah, I mean, it's not like like kind of crazy Mr. Freeze one-liners, but there's some enjoyable quips in here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're having fun. I liked that his headpiece is a bowling ball, too.
Yeah, I mean, double down on balls. You know what I mean?
Great. An area we haven't covered yet.
The Incredible Hulk, number 9 from Marvel, written by, once again, Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Danny Earls. We're getting a new arc here where the Hulk and his young companion have headed to New Orleans while they're still contending with some supernatural entities. This is, I think, what Philip had teased to us as the grossest Hulk transformation ever.
Yeah,
and boy, it sure is. It's pretty gross.
Yeah, real slow-mo Hulk popping out of every little hole he can find in Bruce Banner.
Oh, man.
I really like this. It feels so different from so many Hulk stories and so deep into like hot summer, sweaty horror comic. And it's like, it's good. It feels like very much of a place. New Orleans really feels like a part of this. And it feels like we've established our cast. We've established a villain. Now we get to play around with the stories we're telling. So really nice to feel this entering a sort of new phase in this run.
Yeah, I mean, just the art is just so awesome and stylized, and it kind of just really sets up this world to explore in such a great way. This is intense, but it's also interesting. But the body horror is for real in this.
John Constantine, Hellblazer, Dead in America, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Simon Spurrier, art by Aaron Campbell. Talking about body horror. Talking about body horror. Anyway, lots of that in this issue. John Constantine is slowly dying in America, per the title. And he has been sent on a mission by the new Sandman, not Morpheus, but Daniel, the Sandman, to find some sand.
Old Danny.
As you would want to do.
Do you think when Morpheus named him Daniel, how did that work? Was he like, let's go with a modern
yeah, name. Why not? I start every issue of this so far being like, what's going on here? This is too dense. There's too many things going on. And by the end, I'm like, okay, all right, here we go. I'm into this. Yeah, this is great. So I don't know if that's going to be the arc of every issue, but that's definitely how I felt with issue 1 and 2 so far.
Yeah, and it is, it's scooping up so much of not just Constantine and the different iterations of him, but all of Vertigo. Like, we get a lot of like, hey, Swamp Thing, do your, psychedelic tuber thing, man. And then he does, and we get it's really weaving in and out of a lot of just John Constantine history. And it feels like, I don't know, this is obviously not going to be the last statement for John Constantine, but it feels like this book is about sort of making that, weaving that all together into this story.
Yeah, this is such a fun issue. I super tight bananas art, and I just felt very classic Constantine with me, with all the twists and turns. Just really loved it. Also, some beautiful splash pages in here. The Swamp Thing reveal, as Justin already spoiled, is just glorious.
James Bond, 007, number 2 from Dynamite, written by Garth Ennis, art by Rafa Lobosco. We were, I don't know if mixed is the right word, but concerned about the direction of this after the first issue in terms of how it treated James Bond and the franchise. How are you feeling after issue number 2?
It just doesn't feel like a James Bond book, and it's fine. Like, it's interesting what's happening, but I'm like, what's James Bond about this? And I still don't know, even after the second issue.
Not to jump ahead of you, Pete, feel like even Rafa Lobosco is drawing Butcher from The Boys here. Like, straight up, there's a panel at the end that's like, that's not James Bond, that's Butcher. Which is fine. I mean, I like Garth Ennis, and I think Rafa Lobosco's art is good. But this does not feel James Bondian to me. I agree.
Yeah, I just feel like this is a... You know, I'm trying to tell myself it's a different, more violent take on James Bond. And the art is really good. It's an interesting idea. And part of me is enjoying this. But I'm kind of like, I don't know if it was just a guy who wasn't James Bond, would I care as much? So I don't know. But I'm in it to win it. So I'm going to keep reading.
All right. X-Force number 49 from Marvel, written by Benjamin Percy, art by Robert Gill. The Beast is on the loose and X-Force is after him. However, there's also a second Beast. They clone the Beast back to a backup, back from the days when he was like, oh, my stars and garters. And in this issue, that Beast heads off to pal off with Wonder Man, who is also in a very different place, and be like, you got to help me. We're best friends. And Wonder Woman's like, we haven't talked in a very long time. Yeah, what are you talking about?
I love that energy in this issue. Letterman's like, what? We haven't talked since college. What are you doing here?
Yes, Pete.
Okay, so Justin, remember before when I was saying that, you know, when you were bringing up the clone craze and, you know, copy number four of somebody, when somebody's like, you know, Wolverine's like, which Beast? I'm like, yeah, exactly. There are so many fucking copies running around here. We got old trench coat fucking Beast over here, and then the organic grenade throwing Beast, and then there's like underwater scuba organic.
No, there's two. There's
it's
two.
Just two.
Well, but still, I just
think of the action figures.
I'm over beasted.
Just a quick question: when you see somebody you know and they were on the beach and then they go into the water for the beach, are they two different people?
Hey, jackass! When one of them is doing something completely different, and then in a completely different scenario, you don't know. And they're talking about how there's so many fucking beasts running around. Maybe it could be a different beast.
I know you normally only see me podcasting. If you saw me upstairs making dinner, would you be like, "Well, that's a different Alex"?
Who is that? Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe.
No, fair enough.
Yeah. Kitchen Alex.
And we were just talking about how there was so many Alexes and there was copies of Alex. And then I thought maybe, well, I don't know. They're fucking loose with everything else. Maybe it's a different fucking time period. I don't fucking know.
Yeah, I feel like, Pete, you become untethered from all of the X universe in general. And so you're looking at it that it's too chaotic for you. Like a 31-year-old trying to understand the internet. You think it's too complicated and confusing.
I think there's a really good emotional base going on here. The idea of, are we destined to always be the people that we will become down the road? Like, that's a classic time travel trope. And to see that at play here with them talking about this classic version of the Beast, and they're like, he has the possibility of becoming this Beast who, spoilers here, but at the end of the issue is like, I'm going to suck all of Mars into a black hole to save mutants, which is like, what is the insane villain plan? Totally untethered from reality. So dealing with that idea there, that's, I think the key is the conversation, I believe it's between Sage and Wolverine, where Sage is like, I used to be an alcoholic. I'm not anymore. Am I always alcoholic? You have done horrible things as Weapon X. Are you always Weapon X? Great stuff.
Agreed. That was great. There's just a lot of great writing here, and I like the two beasts. The beast that meets Wonder Man reminded me of when there's just two in this comic. But the beast that meets Wonder Man reminded me of when Donatello would put on a trench coat and go and like solve mysteries in Teenage Mutant Cheryl. They're like, okay.
No, and but in the X-Men cartoon, there was the trench coat beast. I remember trench coat beast.
Yeah, and he's back. Yeah. And I just think that this book is just taking wild swings all the time. And I appreciate that as the X universe, in opposition to the Kieran Gillen book, which is like so intense, so continuity. This one feels like it's just taking swings and having fun.
I mean, the elephant in the room that we haven't talked about yet is this comic pushing Big Coffee. I mean, you have Wolverine and Sage sitting down for coffee. Then one of the beasts is drinking coffee. I mean, I get it. Folger crystals aren't going to sell themselves. You know what I mean? We got it.
I've never tried coffee before, but this book made me take a sip.
Same thing as Ultimate Spider-Man. Uncle Ben and J. Jonah Jameson have that conversation where Uncle Ben assures him.
That was in a hot sauna. They weren't drinking coffee.
No, but they were talking about it. J. Jonah Jameson was like, I drink two cups of coffee a day. Is that okay for me? Don't tell me if it's not. Just tell me it is. And Ben Parker is like, it is. And he's like, great.
Great.
And I felt very seen in that moment.
Oh, that's nice.
Animal Pound number two for Boom Studios, written by Tom King, art by Peter Gross. We are getting into it now as our cats and dogs and buddies are trying to figure out their governmental structure, how they're going to get food, what's going to go on there. Again, this was another issue that on the first issue, I was like, how is this going to play out? This is the one where we get to see how it is going to play out. It really starts to dig into modern ideas of government. Smartly done. Great art by Peter Gross. There's some really interesting satire going on here throughout from Tom King. Excellent book.
Agree. I love this. It's so smart. It's such a difficult story to retell. Animal Farm, the George Orwell book. So hard to retell and modernize. But Tom King is doing it. And I feel like I'm hanging on every scene here. Very much looking forward to more.
Do you guys think it was a bit much when that one dog was like, my mom was a wise bitch? I thought that was a little much. I thought
yeah,
that was
nasty.
But that's not like a bit much. I thought it was a bit much.
That's not a swear word for them.
Yeah. But it was like, I don't know, man. It was like one of the moments where the character looks at the camera in the show and you're like, all
like
right.
Like Deadpool.
We don't have to. Don't bring Deadpool into this. I'm just saying
who
that
lets
like
the dogs out plays or something like that.
That's fun.
I just felt like it was a little much. I was having a good time, and then that happened. I was like, what are we doing?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Your mom's a wise bitch, though.
Don't you fucking dare, bro.
No, it's a compliment.
No, he's speaking from a dog's point of view.
Exactly. Woof, woof. Captain Marvel, number 5 for Marvel, written by Alyssa Wong, art by Jen Bazaldúa. We are dealing with Captain Marvel and this new thief character that I really should find out the name of. Switching places with Naga Bands.
Yuna,
maybe something like that.
I think it's
in
Yuna.
This issue, they are fighting against the villains who are an evil Captain Marvel and a bird lady, and also bonding with the new thief's family. I love this book. This is so much fun. I'm having such a good time. The characterizations are great. This is such a different mode for Carol Danvers. Very fun stuff.
Agree. This has been the best Captain Marvel run in quite some time. I love it. Her name is Yuna. And it's just a great a character. Captain Marvel is often, Carol Danvers is often just like, I gotta go fight all these people. And I think that just to reformat this book and make it this way is such a smart choice.
Yeah, this is just so much fun and so great. I was just so impressed with this issue. Amazing art, great storytelling, lots of action, like the villains. Yeah, this is just, I read it and I was like, great. Thank you.
Read and weep.
I mean, you know, I didn't cry, but it was still good.
You wept.
Superman number 11 from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by David Baldi. On after Superman has returned to the present from the Old West, he's discovered that Lex and his allies are under attack by the new Lex Revenge Squad. By the end of the issue, Superman himself has been corrupted by them. What'd you guys think about this?
I've been liking this. It's such a different type of Superman story, and it's fun and different. My big takeaway is that Mr. Graft, every time I see him, I'm like, is that Howard Stern? He looks like Howard Stern. And like a young Howard Stern. And I think it's just very funny the way this character has been designed.
I think the art's amazing on this. This is not my favorite Superman story, but I'm going to keep reading.
This issue is okay. I feel like some of them have been bigger swings, but this is an important mythology issue for what's going on in the title, so that's okay. There's some fun stuff with the different kryptonites that I enjoyed.
Yes.
I continue to really like this. I continue to have fun reading this, and I'm excited to see where it goes. Lotus Land number 4 from Boom Studios, written by Darcy von Poelgeist, art by Caio Philippe. We are following a neo-noir future detective investigating a weird mystery while back home his son, or is it his son, is waiting for him. Lots of twisty weird things going on with memory in this issue in particular. Pete, what did you think about this one?
Well, it's a lot of crazy stuff. Love the sweet ending. Fantastic art. Sets a great mood for this comic.
It is a moody comic, and I think in the last issue and this one, I was like, I don't quite know what's happening across the board. And I do think walking out of this issue, it feels like maybe that's a little bit the point.
Yeah, it feels a little dreamlike. I think that's what's going on with the Lotus Land, whole Lotus Eaters forgetting things thing. Daredevil number 6 from Marvel, written by Saladin Ahmed, art by Aaron Cooter. In this issue, Daredevil is literally finally facing his demons, thanks to Doctor Strange, trying to find out what's going on, leading to a new/old costume that he gets. Justin, what's your take on this one?
I've been a little bit hesitant with some of the issues in this run, and I thought this issue actually brought it together in a nice way. I wish it had just come a little bit earlier because it crystallizes the mission. The art, I feel like, was a bit of a step up here from Aaron Cooter's great. And this issue especially felt like a bit of a statement issue. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be hard for Daredevil to keep this new uniform clean in general. Uh-huh. Like, you're fighting crime in, like, pure
uniform in Hell's Kitchen.
Oh, just dingy.
I don't know what you're trying to say about Hell's Kitchen. That's
I used to live
clean.
There.
Yeah.
It was not clean.
Yeah, that was back then. Now you can walk around in white.
Everyone's
also, Mr. Clean makes these new eraser kind of thing, magic erasers. It just really helps you out.
I hope we get an issue where Daredevil has to buy those.
Yeah.
Some kind.
Yeah.
Mr. Clean. Sorry. Just have to do it.
All right. Yeah, you have to. That's true. You established that. What a last panel. I mean, holy shit. I was not expecting that. I love this kind of Gandalf moment that Daredevil has, where he kind of goes through hell, comes back, and has got his white outfit on. So,
he says.
Yeah, exactly.
If he keeps running around in Hell's Kitchen, he's going to go back to being Daredevil the Gray,
Boy, yeah. I mean, we'll see what happens. But, yeah, I mean, it was kind of tripped out the way he was falling through hell and stuff, so that was very cool. I don't know if I should spoil the ending, but...
quick question. Hell is where you are right now. Is it like that, like in the comic book?
No, it's not. It's worse. It's worse here than the comic.
That's dark.
Wow.
Well, anyway, good issue, gorgeous art. Titans number 8 from DC Comics, written by Tom Taylor, art by Steven Segovia. We are picking up after the end of the Beast World storyline with a bunch of things going on for the Titans, not least of which is that Raven is Dark Raven, taken over by the evil parts of her soul and working with Trigon. This is very much a pickup issue, and I'm curious to see where they go. But as always, this is a good title.
Same. I feel the same way. I like the way they're bringing in, sort of folding in a lot of the larger continuity stuff happening in DC with we get the heroes being hated, especially Gar. And it really, they make that emotionality really hit home here in a good way. I like the different things that are happening. One quibble. Mm-hmm. They're like, all right, the new T-Jet, let's get in it. And then they're like, then we'll fly there and teleport, immediately land the plane through the teleportation and get out and fight crime. I was like, you don't need the jet. You need the jet at all. Just boom tube there or whatever.
You don't need the jet at all.
You wasted a lot of money in that jet, guys. And think of the carbon footprint. Taylor Swift. And, you know what I'm talking
about? Wow, look at you. Look at
Topical.
You. Yeah, very way to kind of connect. Anyways, great issue. I love how it starts with Raven and her dad. That's great. Also, heartbreaking stuff with Beast Boy, which was very cool. The plane stuff was weird. I was like, why do we have an X-Men plane that you guys are kind of like, hey, it's kind of like the X-Men plane, but legally it's not, right, guys? Cool.
Yeah, you can see the Marvel lawyers just in the edge of the panel.
Yeah. Just if you.
It was nice of them to draw them in, honestly. St. John, number 2 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Brennan Wagner and Dan Shkodky, art by Dan Shkodky. This is based on a clothing line, I want to say, out of Portland, is what I'm gathering here, or something like that. Anyway, it is about a guy who is the spirit of Portland, and he is saving the city in the middle of a snowstorm. We, shockingly... love the first issue of this. What'd you guys think about the second one?
This comic is all about good vibes. Like, this is a hero who's just, like, trying hard and doing well. And sort of like what I was saying earlier about midlife, you don't get a lot of stories where it's just, like, a hero trying to get by. And this is just the pure positive version of that. If you like that, you can pick this up.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it had a cute ending. Love the art style, almost cartoonish in nature, which brings a real lightness to this post-apoc world. It's set in, like the Toon main characters.
It's not a post-apoc world. It's just a snowstorm in Portland.
Yeah.
Well, you call that what
you want. Have you ever dealt with snow, Pete?
Never. Not once in my life.
I really like this as well. I think Dan Shkatke's art reminds me, maybe I said this about the first issue, of Michael Avon Oeming a little bit. It's not quite as exaggerated, but it's definitely there. Good comic book. Very surprised by the second issue as well. Last but not least, Gods number 5 from Marvel, written by Jonathan Hickman, art by Valerio Schiti. In this issue, our...
Oh, don't die.
Oh, no. We got so close to
the end. Guy Holy who Schiti. Is not Doctor Strange is recruiting... our girl who is working for the opposite end of the spectrum to investigate some otherworldly entities. I thought this issue was fun. I still don't know what this series is or exactly what the overall path is, but as a done in one issue, I thought this was very good.
I feel the same way, and I don't know what this is, but I feel like it's been that way from the jump, and we're bookending the stack with Hickman on Hickman. And it's still good. It's still interesting. It's fun stuff. But yeah, the overall project isn't clear, but I don't mind it. I'm here for the ride. The art's great. Good comics.
I thought this was an intense ish. I liked it. Mazeball's art, great amount of story and cool ass shit happening. And yeah, cool world. Love what we were seeing.
I think what Hickman's dealing here, just in case anybody is curious and then we can wrap up, is he is wrapping up the continuity that he left behind after Secret Wars, because there's a little bit of a hint of Black Swans and all that mythology he built up here. He mentions, like, we are from a story that was left behind or something. So that's kind of what he's doing, is he's like, I did all of that work.
Remember that, guys?
Remember that? It's back now. So we'll see how that pans out and how it goes. But good comic, though I'm curious to see what the long-term plan is, because there always is one. If you'd like to support this show and all the shows we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast, many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
When we release in our sweater weather cover, guys, sweater weather cover, Comic Book Club sweater weather.
Of the day.